Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. And I just made the person sitting across from me crack up. His name and title, our senior writer, Jonathan Strickland.
But reverse that.
Yes.
I love the band. We all do. But there's other things in life, you know, that's more important.
Actually, we're not going to be talking a lot about bands, per se.
No, but we are talking about music.
Definitely.
The history of music and video games. And I have an interest in this, because, of course, you know, I'm a gamer. I enjoy playing video games. But I really had, early on, a very deep fascination and admiration for some of the greats in video game music. And you have to remember, Chris and I both come from an era in which home video games either had no music at all when they first came out, or no sounds at all when they first came out, or the sounds were, let's call them, primitive.
I think that's that may be an oversimplification, because we had, well, you know, the early Pong games. Well,
yes, Beep Boop, you're right. That's incredibly sophisticated. I retract my statement. Beep Boop is an amazing, amazing soundtrack.
Okay. Let's just point that out. Now, we've talked about the history of video games in different contexts in many podcasts now.
Sure, yes.
Not to get back into that, but you know, video games are several decades old now.
Yes.
Okay. The first one that I found, according to my research, was Pong.
Mm.
Nolan Bushnell's amazing video game Pong with
magnificent octopus.
Yeah.
His magnificent octopus.
I still enjoy Pong to some degree. It's very simple, but sometimes the simple games are fun.
Yeah,
I wouldn't play it exclusively.
If there's no paint for me to watch dry, I love a good game of Pong.
All right. Fair
enough.
No. But yes,
I actually do like playing Pong too. I'm grouchy because my medication is wearing off.
Note to self: don't record more podcasts with Jonathan when he's sick.
Sorry.
So yeah, Pong okay, we're not talking a lot of soundtrack here, but it did have at least have noise. It had sound effects that went along with the ball hitting the paddle, and then, of course, the ball missing the paddle.
Also hitting the walls.
And hitting the walls, yes.
Beep, boop, beep, boop. And to elaborate on that, before Pong came out, there were a few home game systems, but none of them incorporated sound. They were absolutely silent.
Yep, yep. Now, one of the games that I had sort of forgotten about, and I went to in search of video game music history, and I found it a really awesome timeline by Glenn McDonald out there, if you can find it. Should be pretty easy to find. He brought up one that I had completely forgotten and didn't think of as a video game, and it's really, I guess, technically not, but as an electronic game, Simon, in 1974,
yes.
And I didn't realize it was that old. Simon, it revolves around sound because you're trying to match the colors and lights and sounds in a pattern. And it's a very, very simple game. You just try to repeat. It goes, you know, from the first note to the second note to the third, and you're supposed to repeat back the pattern that it plays for you until you finally miss one and it buzzes.
It gets too complex for you to be able to follow.
But it's funny because I had completely not thought about that as an electronic, a step in the history of electronic gaming and sound. The next one he mentioned was another favorite of mine back from my days hanging out at the skating rink, Taito's Gunfight. Which was the first to use, rather than using hardwired circuits, it used the actual microprocessor to make the sounds.
Yeah, we should point out that these early game systems, everything was hardwired into the console. Like the Pong game, you couldn't play other games on that system. That's all it did.
Was
play the variations of Pong.
Yeah.
And so all the sounds that the console could make were hardwired into the circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing beyond that. And a lot of these early games, like Simon, same thing. If you had a Simon, it's not like you could suddenly play music. I mean, apart from music that would have four notes to it and a little noise if you got anything wrong. You couldn't play a song on it.
No.
Because it only had those four tones it was capable of making.
Yes. Now that's, you know, in contrast to other machines, actually it reminds me a little bit of Loops, which just came out in the last year.
I have one of those.
You do have Loops?
Mm-hmm.
So do I.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. I didn't know that. But yeah, you can actually play music on that to some degree. But the sound, there are far more advanced sounds on that. Another system, actually one that I own, the Atari 2600, also had hardwired sounds on it.
Yeah.
You were limited. The people who would program games that would come on the cartridges, which are using ROMs,
yes.
You snap into place in the cartridge slot.
Read-only memory.
Yes. The people who programmed games had to take advantage of the sounds that were hardwired into the console itself.
Yeah, it was a very limited sound library.
And so, you know, what you had to deal with was, you know, your standard and lots of little. I still remember the McDonald brought it up, but I still remember the tank sound from combat. That
right. There were various beeps and bloops that were at different pitches, so you could make some very, very primitive music. Essentially, you would hard program it onto the cartridge, and that would tell the console, okay, make these noises.
Mm-hmm.
So this is still like besides the gunfight game. These are more like Simon, and as far as music goes, they're more like Simon than they are a computer with a dedicated sound card or system for handling sound files.
Yes, just to clarify, Gunfight was a standalone arcade game.
Yes.
And so was the initial version of Pong. But there were Pong and its many, many clones made it into the home, and along with the Atari 2600. Do you know what the first system was that took advantage that didn't have to be hardwired on a home system?
If I had to guess, I'd say it was the NES.
No, actually, it was another system that you probably did not have. I don't think you've ever mentioned having
What's
it.
That?
The Odyssey 2.
No.
Had programmable. Stop laughing. Had programmable cartridges, and the programmers could encode a sound library on the cartridge itself. And it also had speech synthesis, mm-hmm. which explained why it sold so well. Oh, wait a minute.
The Intellivision also had speech synthesis.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
It usually was pretty primitive. There were normally just a few words that each game would be able to do. I had B-17 Bomber. That's exactly how it sounded, too. I'm not. If any of you guys had that game out there, you know what I'm talking about.
Well, actually, McDonald said that Major League Baseball was the first talking game. Did you have that one?
With Strike. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had that one, too.
1979.
Yep, I had that game as well. Yep. I'm not proud of this.
No. It's okay. Well, you know what? At the time, though, it was... It was a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's funny. One of the things that McDonald pointed out in his timeline was even though these systems were primitive in terms of sound design and soundscaping compared to now, I mean, what we have now, we've got actual songs from regular recording artists that are actually encoded into the game. Even without that level of sophistication, they still provided a lot of context and character and richness for the game player. He specifically mentioned Space Invaders.
Yes.
Because you hear them marching. And as they get closer and closer to the planet, it speeds up. And you hear the sound of it speed up. And that you know, constant, you know, increasing.
It triggers your panic response.
It does. And you wouldn't think, that's kid stuff. That's no big deal. It really does have an effect. And it has effect on how you feel when you're playing the game. And increases your desire to kill off those little buggers.
Yeah.
So you can face another wave of those little buggers.
And some of the early arcade games, like, well, you know, things like Pac-Man mm-hmm. and Donkey Kong had their little tiny elements of music to them. It was almost like a jingle for a commercial in the sense that it was not terribly sophisticated, not terribly long, but very, very catching.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Do, 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 do. Yeah. So you can do that. If you try that to someone and they do that, what Chris just did, that means that they were around in the early 80s and they played a lot of Donkey Kong.
Yes. Unfortunately, as I was doing research for this podcast, I got sidelined by VGMusic.com.
Yes, the Video Game Music Archive.
Oh, God.
And it has those different files that you can listen to the music from those video games.
There's a good hour of my life that just disappeared and I don't know where it went.
Well, let's... Do you mind if I skip ahead a bit? I mean, we're talking about a lot of the arcade games and a lot of the Atari-based games, but really the Atari system was pretty primitive.
I was just going to ask you a quick trivia question.
Hit me.
Do you know? Really?
No. I'm grouchy.
He never says that.
I will take it out on Tyler. He had one thing to do today.
Okay, so do you know who wrote the music for Donkey Kong?
I do not.
It was, in fact, Miyamoto-san himself.
Oh, it was Miyamoto.
Yes, Shigeru Miyamoto, who wrote the music for Donkey Kong on a small electronic keyboard, according to Glenn McDonald. So
Miyamoto is a giant in the video game industry.
He is so awesome. But I had no idea. And it's funny to show you that again shows you how ground level he was on this whole thing.
Well, the reason why I was going to skip ahead was that if we want to talk about home consoles, which really...
Yeah, and we should.
We eventually are going to be focusing mostly on the console system because, you know, the arcades eventually faded from popularity. Not that they don't exist anymore, but in the United States, they're few and far between. And the development for games tends to be more focused on the home market than on the arcade market in the United States. There are still mm-hmm. places like Japan where mm-hmm. arcades are huge, but not in the United States so much. Well, I wanted to talk about the original Nintendo system and how it was kind of a huge jump ahead of everything else.
Okay.
Now, one of the reasons why, when I say huge jump ahead, I mean it's primitive compared to today's consoles, but at the time was a big deal. It had four whole channels for music.
Well, when you think about it, the NES it came out in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And four-channel stereo was kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And you got to remember that most of these game systems had one channel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if there was a sound effect, it had to interrupt the music.
Mm-hmm.
Or so if there's so like when Mario would jump and go doo doo doo, that little thing it would interrupt the music in the middle of it,
right?
So having a system that would allow you to play four channels of sound was a big deal. Now, one of those channels was usually used for sound effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the other three would be used in various forms for music. I read about game composers who would try and figure out ways to make a four-note chord, which mm-hmm. is hard to do if you've only got three channels.
Yeah.
So what they would do is they would do instead of doing a true chord, they would do essentially a broken chord. They would play the notes back to back so quickly that to us it sounds almost like they were played simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get the effect of the chord without actually truly playing a chord.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other game developers who would allow for music to take over, and then when a sound effect comes in, it would drop one channel out of the four out so the mm-hmm. sound effect could take place.
Yeah, because typically, I'm sure a lot of our musician listeners are going to say, well, you would, a chord really only requires three notes.
Sure.
But you would want the richness and depth of additional octaves in there, too.
Right, right. And I want to mention one guy in particular
okay.
as really being instrumental, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little pun for you.
Uh-huh.
In the development of video game music. As far as its effect in the game industry.
I'm interested to see who this is.
Koji Kondo.
Ah.
The composer for both Super Mario Brothers
mm-hmm.
and Legend of Zelda.
Ah,
and
yes.
And the reason why I'm singling out Koji Kondo, and please, people, don't write into me and tell me that I should talk about some other composer, because we're going to talk about a few others before the end of this. But the reason why I wanted to single him out and mention him is because... he sort of created this idea in the video games of different environments having different soundtracks.
Right.
So when you moved from one environment into another, you would get a new tune playing in the background, and this would enhance your video gaming experience. Now, with Super Mario Brothers, it was pretty simple. There was one tune for when you were above ground, and there was one tune when you were in the dungeon levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there was a different one when you were underwater. So the interesting part there is that this really gave composers for video games, it really gave them a shot in the arm saying, oh, this can be more than just adding a little extra element into a video game. It's more than just the icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
There's an element here that can be intrinsic to the video game playing experience. Now, at the time, most of the composers for video games were working exclusively with one developer.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, actually, some of the earliest video games, the composers were people who were just on staff who happened to also be musicians.
Right.
So, in the video game industry, when it first started out, they didn't have the resources or the clout, really, or the prestige to attract, quote-unquote, real composers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say quote-unquote because I consider the guys who came up with these video game tunes to be real composers because, a lot of these tunes I'm still a big fan of.
Yeah, you're speaking of people who are dedicated to composing. That's
right.
What they do.
That's their main occupation.
Job. Right.
And then eventually you got to a point where video game developers would be able to hire someone who specifically specialized in music. But even mm-hmm. then, they were another person on the company payroll. It's not like you commissioned someone to compose music for your video game.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that makes the video game music really interesting that I think Koji Kondo... kind of launched was this idea of the interactive experience in that things that the player does changes the environment in some way. And in this case, it would change the music that's playing in the background, depending on where the player was.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally a different experience than composing music for either a film or just composing music, period, like mm-hmm. creating a symphony, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because in those, it's the audience is passive.
Right.
There's nothing the audience can do that's going to alter the progression of the music short of causing a scene at a live symphony. Don't do that, by the way.
It's been done.
No, I don't.
Hundreds of years ago.
I don't want to do that anymore. I'm tired of being thrown out of all the symphony halls in the United States. Though I could, still haven't been thrown out of the opera house in Sydney. So anyway, there's a goal.
it seems like it would almost be closer to movie music.
And
in a lot of ways, than it would be to traditional symphonic music because it's programmatic. It has a theme to it, and it actually is helping tell the story.
Right. It's meant to help elevate the experience. But even with movie music, you still have a set series of events, right?
Well, that's why I said closer to.
Exactly. But to elaborate on your point, the reason why it's even different from that is the second time you watch that movie, unless you're watching some really weird choose your own adventure thing, is going to progress the exact same way you saw it the first time.
Clue, anyone?
And the 100th time. Okay, sure. Clue, the end of Clue, for those of you who don't know, Clue came out in like 1984, starring Tim Curry, and was phenomenal and had three different endings. But apart from that, in most situations, the 800th time you watch the movie is going to be the same as the first as far as the progression of scenes go, barring director's cuts and all that mess. So, in other words, the composer does not have to create musical segues or musical themes that will be incorporated or perhaps mixed in with other themes based upon what the character's going through.
So,
yes.
This is also the era in which I think, possibly because a lot of us grew up with this type of music, but I think this era is also what inspired what would later become, people who play these kinds of video game scores for others as, a symphonic piece and things, because some of this music is just so memorable for us. And I wanted to mention the work of Nobuo Uematsu.
Is that the guy who did
Final Fantasy?
Yeah.
Because that, for so many people, is big deal.
The definitive video game music for a large portion of the players out there. Not me, because I like playing games that make sense. But, people who enjoy Final Fantasy, I don't know what's wrong with you, but...
They're all...
I'm on medication.
Yeah, blame it on that. Direct your hate mail, too. No. So
off-brand.
But no, they... medication. Yeah. But yeah, they Final Fantasy has soundtracks available.
Yes.
And, I don't know that when all of this started, when the video game craze started, people would have assumed that this, you'd buy a soundtrack for a video game.
What?
Maybe not, but it happens, and it's not unusual anymore.
No, in fact, and there are live performances of video game music.
Exactly.
Everything from, I've seen some great a cappella renditions of classic video game music where they run through several, like including Super Mario Brothers and Legend of Zelda and the classic games of the NES era all the way up.
Yeah. See, that's all from this period. So I think that period is really when it's taken off to the point where it's a something that's noticeable.
Right. And then so the NES really helped set some standards. The next big leap was probably from in 1995 with the introduction of the Sony PlayStation.
Oh.
So, I mean, this is a big leap. Okay, there were...
You're skipping over quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah, there were incremental improvements with the systems between the NES and when the PlayStation came out. Don't get me wrong. There were some great video game songs that came out during that time. But when the Sony PlayStation came out, that allowed up to 24 sampled voices.
Yes.
To play. Now, again, in the previous generation, NES, you could only play discrete sounds capable that the machine was capable of sending to the TV.
Mm-hmm.
The PlayStation allowed you to actually sample music.
Yep, it even lets you use effects like looping and reverb.
Yeah,
which you couldn't do before, and it also had CD quality audio since.
Yes.
Rather than using cartridges, as so many of these other games did in the past, we were actually dealing with an optical disc.
And it allowed for three different types of music within video games. The first
good,
one...
Good, bad, and terrible?
You could argue that.
I'm teasing.
The first one was musical instrument digital interface.
MIDI.
MIDI. Now, MIDI is... It's essentially like a language, really. And depending upon the synthesizer that's in your...
I was just going to mention, some of them are very tiny and give you the force.
Oh, good Lord. So, not the midichlorians.
You hate those.
I do hate them. Passion that burns brighter than a thousand exploding suns. No, MIDI, it's a any device, any computer that has a synthesizer in it
right.
can play back the information stored in a MIDI file. And depending upon the synthesizer, it'll sound different in each machine, right?
Right.
So, MIDI is not like a standardized sound. It's a standardized way of recording, like of presenting music. It's kind of like a piano roll,
yeah.
An old player piano. So you have two different player pianos, and one of them's in the style of a grand piano, and one of them's in the style of a honky-tonk piano, and you put the same roll of piano player paper in them,
mm-hmm.
One of them is going to sound very different from the other, even though they're both playing the same notes.
Yes.
Okay. So the Sony PlayStation was capable of playing MIDI music. It was also capable of playing mods or digital modules.
Oh, yes. I remember that. Now, it's worth noting that some computers had been using these different types of formats for years.
But, yes.
But they weren't really common in home video game consoles,
right.
Probably because the hardware, I'm guessing, hardware needed to do that was probably going to be pretty expensive.
Well, yeah.
Comparatively.
Like in computer games, this ability had been there for years because this is the era when we've already got sound cards for computers like Sound
sure.
Blaster
mm-hmm.
and Roland and all those devices that would come out. And you would actually install the sound card into your computer, which would give your computer the capability of playing back these kinds of sounds.
You yeah.
plug speakers into them, and then you'd have that music. This was before computers would come standard with sound cards. You know, now, most times, if you go out and buy a computer, there's at least some sort of sound card pre-installed
right.
Where it'll play back these file formats. But back in the day, you had to do it yourself. Now, like I said, it took a while for the consoles to catch up. The Sony PlayStation was the first one. So these digital modules, what was interesting to me about these is that it would allow you to record the sound of an individual note of a particular instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So you would record every sound that a tenor saxophone can play individually,
right.
Each note. You'd then record every single note that a piccolo can play. You would record every single note that a violin can play. And so you would have a sample of each of those notes, and then you could build music based on that library of sounds and the various notes they're able to play.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sort of synthesize the sound of actual music. And it was okay. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was obviously synthesized stuff, but if you were really good at programming with mods, you could make some decent music. Now,
yeah.
The problem is that mods tend to be larger file sizes.
Yes.
And MIDI is actually a very small file size.
Yes, it is.
And so that's one of the reasons why it was so popular in early games, because it didn't take up a lot of space, and you could dedicate that space for things like gameplay.
It's also why
graphics.
Sorry.
No, please.
I was going to say it's also why it was so popular in the mid-1990s on people's homepages.
Yes, because you could host a MIDI file on your homepage, and you didn't have to worry about going over your tiny little cap
yes.
for your webpage. So that's why if you visited a webpage in the early 90s, early to mid-90s, you had that looping MIDI that played some irritating tune, and it was terrible. And
it's
I had
awful.
Those. For me, it was Rule Britannia. Was one of them, and Yo-Ho, A Pirate's Life for Me was another, because I had a page on the British Navy and I had a page on piracy, and you'll never find them, people, so don't worry about it.
Do they still exist?
I think even if you went in the Wayback Machine, you would have trouble finding it. I can't even tell you what the address is now. It's
okay.
been too long.
That's just funny. So we're releasing the Jonathan Strickland Find His Homepage from 1994
Gosh,
contest.
Please don't. I really don't want to see that again. But, okay, so it could play the MIDI files, it could play the mod files. I said it could play three different types of music. The
yes.
third was referred to at the time as Redbook.
Ah, Redbook.
Which is CD audio.
Quality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Redbook, of course, you could make CD quality music. So you could create a song or a score with a full orchestra if you wanted to,
mm-hmm.
Record it to this format, and it would play it back like that. But the problem is that it takes a lot of processor power to do it. And the article I read, which let me pull up the title here. It was specific. The article is called Video Game Music, Not Just Kid Stuff by Matthew Belinky.
Mm-hmm.
He said that engineers at the time called it stealing time from the laser.
Hmm.
Because the laser is meant to let you play the game. You know, it's reading the data off of the CD.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were dedicating some of that to audio, it was stealing that time to play audio rather than to play the game.
I see.
So that was, but the PlayStation era really kind of pushed things to a new level. And since then, we've got much more sophisticated consoles that are essentially just specialized computers.
Right.
That could do essentially the same thing computers can do. So they could read all the different file formats that computers can read. So depending upon what the video game developer's preference is, that's what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And did you want to add anything? I've got a list of some composers I wanted to go through, but and we've mentioned a couple of them already.
I wanted to mention another note. And this is actually something that sort of came up in our Sega Saga podcast. Yeah. Do you remember Resident Evil?
Yes.
It was one of the very first games to start using realistic sound effects, which when you're playing a survival horror game...
That's important.
Can be. It's very important. Again, it adds a lot of depth and feeling to the game that you wouldn't have gotten with just music. But it's also... taking us a little that other step closer to being in sort of an interactive movie environment where things are you do have some control over it, but it's much more realistic and cinematic than it would have been playing, you know, Berserk.
Yeah.
You know, also not zombies, but, you know, still. Well, yeah.
Robots.
Yes. Don't touch the walls.
And, you know, we mentioned earlier about live performances of these.
Oh, yes.
One of the performances I should mention is it's a touring show
mm-hmm.
called Video Games Live.
Ah, yes, I remember that.
It's an orchestral performance of video game music. And they even do things like there's usually a section that walks you through the early, early days of video gaming where, like I was saying, you know, the songs tend to be of jingle length.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be at most 30 seconds of music. That would loop. And so, but they'll play that. And it even begins usually humorously with Pong,
mm-hmm.
where the entire orchestra is going, bing, bong, bing, bong. But, you know, works its way up to some of my favorites, like Elevator Action and Gauntlet.
Oh, yeah.
Doo-doo-doo. Anyway, so that's a fun way of going to experience this video game music. And they do work their way up to more modern songs. And in fact, there have been some composers for television and movies who have composed music for video games. So I have a quick list of some of the folks that I think would be interesting just to mention.
Please do.
Clint Bajakian. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm saying his name correctly. Bajakian is the fellow who wrote the music for Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, as well as some other Star Wars.
Oh.
So here's a challenge, is taking a franchise which already has a very established sound to it,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have to essentially take the foundation that John Williams, the composer for the original movies, the foundation he created, and then to build on that in a way that is respectful and yet is not just a carbon copy of what's already come before.
Right.
Here's Mark Barrel, who wrote the music for the Crash Bandicoot series.
Do a barrel roll.
Barrel roll. David Burgode, Ratchet and Clank.
Oh, yeah.
Greg Edmondson, who did the music for Uncharted.
And Firefly.
There you go. See, there's that crossover. There's Dan Forden. He did Mortal Kombat. Get over here. Jason Hayes did the music for World of Warcraft. Let's see. Michael Hennig, who wrote the music for Baldur's Gate, one of the games I really enjoyed playing. Let's see. Michael Hunter, who did the music for Grand Theft Auto San Andreas and Grand Theft Auto 4. The theme to Grand Theft Auto 4 is one of my favorite video game themes to come out over the last few years. It's
mm-hmm.
It's the Soviet one, and it has this sort of mix between kind of a techno sound and the old Soviet sort of music, that kind of military style music from the Soviet era. And I really enjoyed that one quite a bit. Let's see, there's we mentioned Koji Kondo, of course. There is Michael Land, who wrote one of my probably my favorite video game score of all time. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's the Monkey Island games.
Oh.
The Monkey Island. I actually have the theme to the Monkey Island games on my MP3 player because that's how much – that's the only video game song – no, wait. I'm sorry. I also have Grand Theft Auto 4 on there. But those are the only two video game songs I have on my MP3 player. There's Robin Miller, who wrote the music for Myst and Riven. Now, you could argue that the music in those games was very much – important to the role of the game to really get that feeling across.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have Martin O'Donnell, who wrote the music to the Halo series, which is very distinctive with the men's chorus, and then later on there's a full chorus. It's actually really some cool stuff. And what's funny is that, as I recall, the original recording of the men's chorus were that was actually guys who were working for Bungie, who got together in a recording studio and did a, they all just sang into the microphones. And I apologize, people. I'm sick. I don't know what I'm doing. But yeah, that's my list. Now, I know there's a thousand other video game composers out there, but that's just a quick list that I grabbed together.
You know one I'm surprised you didn't mention.
Who's that?
Michael Giacchino.
Oh, yes, Michael Giacchino, who went on to write the music for television, like Lost.
Yes, and The Incredibles, which I'm actually more of a fan of his movie music.
He wrote for music for Medal of Honor, right?
Yes, EA? He did.
Uh-huh. See, it's all up there somewhere.
See, yep, there you go.
I didn't even have that written down.
And that's the funny thing too. When you now that we have this kind of level of crossover that we really didn't have before between movies, TV, and video games. I mean, they're all franchising one another. Once you come up with a good title, try to
hit as many variations of media as you possibly can.
So there are crossovers too. He also did the music for Alias, but did the video games too. I mean the Incredibles game, Up, Ratatouille. I'm just looking at some of the video game titles. You can see him on his site. But yes, he did the whole the Medal of Honor series, and also did Call of Duty: Finest Hour, and some of the other Call of Duty games. So. It's just amazing too that it has come this far, but wouldn't have been able to do that without the hardware necessary to make that happen, and you know, the programming ability to add that in.
And there's some games out there that do this ability of this interactive experience of really meshing all the music together in ways that are truly phenomenal. For example, the Red Dead Redemption game.
Yeah.
Has, you know, it's a Western. It's set in the West, just as the Old West is dying. It's the turn of the century, so it's the early 1900s, and it has music that changes based upon the environment you're in. So when you are in the Old West, it's kind of that Old West sort of music. When you move into Mexico, it's a lot of like horns and mariachi style music. But it also uses music to songs to a really, really good effect. There's a spoiler alert. Spoiler alert for people who have not played Red Dead Redemption yet. When you first manage to make your way to Mexico, as soon as you land, once you get past the big mission that lets you get there, there's a song that plays. And it is shocking when you first hear it, not for the content of the song, but because you had only been listening to environmental music and instrumentation up to that point. But then you get into Mexico and an actual song with lyrics and vocals, you know, it starts up, and it's so powerful a moment that it surprises you.
Yeah.
And by the way, don't get off your horse if you want to listen to the song, because I found out the hard way. When I saw something like, oh, there's a plant I need to pick up, and I got off the horse and started picking up, the song faded away, and then I got back on the horse thinking, oh, maybe it'll come back. No. Had to reload. But it was really, I mean, that those kind of moments are, you can see that that's built on that foundation from the NES days.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're just capable of making much more sophisticated music than we were back then. So I expect that the musical aspect of video games will continue to grow in importance. And, of course, we'll continue to cherish those older tunes that just sort of evoke that feeling that we got back when we were, you know, in our teens, early teens, playing various video games.
Well, that was awesome. And we didn't even get into things like the music games.
Yeah, like
specifically like
Guitar Hero and Rock Band and
Parappa the Rapper.
Parappa the Rapper.
Parappa the Rapper.
Parappa the Rapper. Yep. All the harmonics games. All the harmonics games. Yeah, there's tons of. That's a whole podcast to itself. Just where music is the gameplay. It's not just to enrich it, but it is the gameplay.
Yes,
we'll have to do another episode on that at some point. So let's wrap this one up. If you guys have any, tell us what your favorite video game music is. Let us know. We're curious. Tell us on Twitter or Facebook. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW, or you can email us. That address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.